take a deep breath, take the higher road. That's what they always say, as if they know the way. They won't take it from me. But don't ever doubt yourself, it's life ain't just a dream. You make your own, so kick and scream. The people move alike with a never-ending force. You never had the chance, so what you waiting for? The day has come, my friend, cause this is war.
Welcome to Nurses Out Loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio, Friday edition with Nurse Michelle. Today, we're going to be talking about addiction and some other topics that may surprise you how much the American people have this in common with each other. According to results from a new survey, show that drug and alcohol addiction is commonplace in U.S. families. Two-thirds of people said they or someone in their family have experienced addiction or overdose. Pew Research wrote in 2017, it's common for Americans to know someone with a current or past drug addiction, and it's an experience that mostly cuts across demographic and partisan lines. A Pew Research Center survey conducted in August of 2017 found that 46% of U.S. adults say that they or have a family member or close friend who is addicted to drugs or has been in the past. Identical shares of men and women say this, 40% of each. The National Institute of Health, according to the Centers for Disease Control, say 13% of Americans have reported increasing or starting substance use as a way of coping with stress related to the pandemic. An overdose reporting system known as ODMAP also reported an 18% increase nationwide in opiate overdoses since the pandemic. It is estimated that 10 to 15% of the population has addictive personality, and this percentage of population doesn't know when to stop and has a more difficult time coping with drugs and alcohol. And another survey stated that most Americans with substance abuse disorders don't receive treatment, that over 46 million Americans age 12 and older had a substance abuse disorder in 2021, and that is a whopping 16.5% of the population, only 6% of whom actually received treatment, according to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. I want to encourage our listeners, if you have questions or comments from today's topic or from our interviewee today, or questions you have for the nurses, send your questions directly to nurses@americaoutloud.com. We will be featuring your questions and comments on a special Q&A episode with the nurses. Today's special guest on Nurses Out Loud is David Ragsdale. I met him because while doing a sound check before an interview on the Vaccine Safety Research Foundation with Steve Kirsch, I ran into technical difficulty, and the nurse that was trying to help me was definitely getting frustrated. And over the hour that we were feverishly trying to get me sound checked, I pleaded for anybody who could help me that had technical knowledge. And I met this person by the name of David, who was stuck with the frustrating nurse who could not figure out how to shut down probably 1,000 sites on Chrome that I keep open and always cause myself issues. So before I bring him on and let him tell you something, I want to read something from an article that he wrote that was entitled "Finding the Creature, Escaping the Homelessness Trap." When I finally woke up, it took me 5 weeks to get myself out of homelessness. I had been homeless for a few years, apparently, but I didn't really know it. I didn't know until I did. And it came to me that day, the clarity. I couldn't not be homeless. It wasn't a game anymore. It was what it was. And I was a goner. Though the day I realized this, I knew I didn't want to be gone. I didn't want one day without place. Beyond any other thing, I wanted home. But I was deeply homeless, which was the difficult thing. Waking up meant living the terror for real, for real, for real. So welcome, David Ragsdale, to America Out Loud and Nurses Out Loud.
Thank you for having me. It's a great honor.
That was a very profound, and if I feel the profoundness that you were actually experiencing yourself. So I really want to bring this topic to our audience because apparently it is much more prevalent than we realize.
Yeah. And, you know, the interplay between homelessness and addiction is deep and they're heavily enmeshed in each other. And for me, the addiction part was actually like the awareness part that I couldn't stop using or drinking and both. That was simpler. The homelessness aspect of it was much more difficult to figure out. And it actually took me a few years, right? Because it didn't start as waking up and realizing that I'm in Atlanta, where I'm not from. And it's a strange city because you could be in the middle of the city and you think you're in a forest. And all the streets wind and curve against each other. So you're like, I'm trying to walk to that tall building. And I've been walking in that direction, but I curved back away from it again. And if you're not from Atlanta, it can be like a inverted spider web.
Where were you from?
I'm from LA. I'm here from Los Angeles. So I had come out to Atlanta to start a music festival, actually. And I got close, but my addiction decided that it wanted to win more than my vision for a music festival, and my addiction won. But the homelessness aspect of it, the real core of what happened to me, and really that was more of the point of the essay. Addiction led me to homelessness, but the homelessness part was really about that. And that actually was like a spiral. And it wasn't like, so the federal government, or at least before COVID, I don't know how it defines it now, it defined homelessness as not owning a home, having a mortgage, or having a tenancy agreement, right? So if technically, according to HUD, if you live on your mother's couch or in her spare bedroom or in the bedroom you grew up in, you come back as an adult, you're technically homeless, right? And right, because unless you have a tenancy agreement, right?
I had no idea.
Yeah. So again, I don't know if they've changed that because of COVID, because there were a lot of HUD regulations. So I don't know where the law, or it's not really a law, it's a definition. I don't know where that stands today, but I knew that like in 2018, 2019, that was how they viewed homelessness. So it was a very broad and expansive category. But for me, it started with, you know, I had a good job, I had a really nice apartment. And then it was like, oh, I'm having a problem with drugs. So I'm going to give up my apartment and move into a very expensive sober living. And then I keep using drugs. So then I have to, hey, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to keep my job and move in with my parents back home. And then that situation, and then, oh, I'll go live with a friend for a while. And then it just spirals down and down, and the living situations become more and more tenuous. And then I know I'm going to go to Atlanta and with this crazy idea for a music festival and stay with a good friend there until I have to leave there. And then I end up and I'm with strangers, and then I'm in a motel. And then, so that was like the multi-year progression, right? From starting with my own apartment in LA with a lease to a few years later. And I wasn't even, when I say I woke up, I wasn't even like asleep. I was literally walking through Midtown Atlanta, and it must have been like 4 or 5 in the morning. And I was like, where am I going? Because I remember I was walking so fast, and I wasn't exactly high at the time, but I wasn't exactly clean either. I was in like that in-between state. And so coming down, and I remember I was walking so fast, like I was walking to get somewhere, right? Like I don't want to be late for something. And I remember always with housing and trying to scramble to find housing, I always felt that there was this big clock. And that housing for me felt like a train, and I had to get to the train station on time or the train was going to leave. And that was like constantly with me. And of course that was the drugs largely, but it was also this like spirit feeling that housing was attached to time. And I can't exactly explain what that means, but it was just the feeling I had. And how I woke up is I was walking through Midtown Atlanta, and I don't know, it's like 4:30, 5 in the morning. It's just starting to crack into day, or really, really beginnings of the day. And I remember being like, where am I going? I had no plan. I had no phone at that point. I had no money. I had like a backpack full of like notebooks, full of like rambling writings. I had like two pairs of socks that didn't match. I had a couple of books. I had a bunch of like pens. Half of them didn't work. It was just nuts.
It
And I
dawned
was.
on you that what you even had wasn't going to help you get what you needed.
I was just like, David, where are you going? You have nowhere to go. You have nowhere. And
Had your
that.
parents made an ultimatum after you lived with them that time? Had they said that this isn't really going to be an option again?
No. So, and I don't have kids, so I can't imagine how awful, like, little death it must be for a parent to have a child who goes through this. However, so in one sense, my parents, some people could have considered them enablers. But who knows? I feel like I would never tell a parent who gave their child housing over and over and over and over and over and over again an enabler. I don't know. Like, I don't know what is the, is it the 13th time where you cross the line between being like Christian, who forgives and forgives and forgives the seven times seven times seven, right? Or you become an enabler. I don't know if there's like, you know what I mean? And I also don't, if the parents like at the second time or first time, you can't stay in this house. That I get too. So I think a lot of times people take a lot, even in recovery, people take cheap shots at parents. And I don't think that's particularly helpful, right? Because, but in my case,
They're
I
doing the
had,
best they can because really,
I mean, it's your child.
even yourself, how you found yourself there, you didn't even know how you found yourself there. It's not like there's a book that says once you do this particular drug this many times, this individual is going to end up in a homeless situation, nor has any parenting book ever said how to make sure your child doesn't become a homeless child one day. You think that you're doing everything, you're obviously a successful person living in society, succeeding in society. And you're doing things that the media and the world is saying is perfectly fine to do, occasionally party with, whether it be drugs or alcohol. And everything is being sent that message that it's okay to the American people because we allow that to be the message being sent to the American people through movies and things like that. That nobody knows what to do when they find themselves in the situation themselves or that it's their family member.
Yeah. And it would be different with each person. It's like, who knows? I mean, I think it's really, really like, I don't know. So it's a long answer to your question is I left LA and I came to Atlanta and I was the one who said like, I'm gonna fix myself or I'm gonna make this festival or something's gotta happen, right? And like a lot of people, I came to Atlanta and a lot of people do. And a lot of people get broken in Atlanta, and I was one of them. And I also was resurrected. I rose up in Atlanta. So
Why
what
is
I did,
that? I mean, being that Georgia is my home, what is it
I
about?
don't know. There's something I think so there is a lot of darkness in Atlanta in terms of like temptation and sin and depravity and everything among every class, every race, every gender, every religious or non-religious, every political background. There's something about Atlanta that has the pull of vice and sin and all that. But then there's this other part of Atlanta, right, where you have the light and you have the rising up. And it's this, it's, I find Atlanta, and I'm a native Angelina, I find Atlanta much more interesting than LA because you can see the struggle of man in Atlanta, I think, or at least as I have experienced it, real. Like, I think there are angels and demons in Atlanta. And they're both on every street. And that's gonna sound like spooky or voodoo. I'm a Christian, but like I honestly genuinely believe that. And it's like a battleground for humanity in this city.
Well, you say I'm a Christian, so that may sound kind of spooky, but actually, to be a Christian is to validate that there is a spiritual world. It actually says that we are battling against powers and principalities. It doesn't say humans, it's powers and principalities. So it should be no surprise that we have on every street corner angels and demons.
And
Beware.
it's, yeah, I really feel something. I feel there's something about Atlanta that is will have a special place as the story of man unfolds. And I don't know what that means even, but I feel it. And so when I woke up, I don't know how or why, but I went to Grady. And I don't, and I couldn't tell you like sure, clearly I had heard of it or something. And like this was in January, or very early January of 2017. So we're talking like January 5th, I think.
Okay, let me tell everybody what Grady is. So and when you're in Georgia, Grady is this gigantic medical facility that's right on the interstate. You can't miss it. It is a fortress on a not even on a hill, but those of us that did our nursing training through there, so I had to do some training there. It is something to be afraid of when you are going to do your nurse's training at Grady, because it is going to have the roughest, most indigent patients that there are in the world are going to be your patients. I mean, a lot of them are going to be shackled that you're going to be taking care of. They're going to have rotting body parts coming off their body that have maggots in them. And yes, I'm not surprised that what I'm saying is not some big shocker there. And the burn unit, they're known for the most profound burns from around the country, come to Grady. But there's also a psychiatric ward there that's known. So, did you end up in that setting?
On the 13th floor, which is crazy because, right? So I fell out in front of the library in the West End, and they were, and I kept saying the ambulance came, I just collapsed. And the ambulance came, and they were initially going to take me to Emory Midtown, and then they changed it to Grady. And then, it was in and out, and I wasn't really like conscious. And then when I fully came to, I was in this crazy big like hall with these huge windows with the best views of Atlanta. And they kept saying, "Where am I?" And they said, "You're on the 13th floor." And I thought I was like in purgatory or something, because I'm like, there's no way they're putting a psych ward on the 13th floor, right? Because a lot of buildings don't even have a 13th. I thought it was a joke or something.
Oh my word. So what did big changes happen for you there?
Yeah, so what happened to me there was I got a couple days. So I got a couple days, right? And I got fed and I got showered and I got someone who had like a gazillion cl like clients. I don't know if it was like a care coordinator or social work, I forget what his title was. But he had this like very frayed Excel spreadsheet. These like brochures that were like from 10 years ago. He was doing the best he could though, right? And he kept, there was this sober living or that sober living. And the reality is, I didn't want to go to sober living. So eventually what I did is I discharged myself and I went back into Grady, but not as a psychiatric brought in by the ambulance. And at this point, my head was clear or more clear. And I thought, what do I need? I need housing. I need food. I need a medical check. And then I need like recovery. And I need it in that order. Right. And this is where I had to get a little bit. And this is sometimes the tension in recovery, because a lot of recovery will speak of like surrender and let go and let God, and which is true. But sometimes it's also true that like it's not necessary that every addict, when they get a little bit sober, doesn't have an idea of what to do. And so sometimes people will tell people in very early sobriety, do this, do that, do that. And it's like, well, maybe they should have some input because they may know the sequencing of things. And the sequencing of things is pretty important when you're in early recovery. It's like triage at a hospital, right? So I essentially did a little bit of triage for myself and I said, what do I need in what order? Housing, food, medical check, recovery. So I just went all around Grady. I went to the infectious disease building, which is a hoof away from it. And I came back and I just started knocking on office doors. And I just started saying, hi, my name is David Ragsdale. Apparently I'm homeless. Do you know where I could go for some help? And oh, you have to go to this federal. No, I have to stay in. And I lied. I said, I was told I have to stay in the hospital because they're doing some type of thing like medical check on me. And they're like, oh, well, in that case, go 2 floors up. They do food for indigent people and they'll have some extra meals for you. So then I go up and then I'd be like, okay, here are 3 lunches. Great. I have some food. I still don't have some housing. Great. And so I just went around and just knocked on like office doors and tried to be as like polite as possible, right? And I didn't like bark back. And when someone was like, well, blah, 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 I was like, okay, thank you. And you know what I mean? Because it, like a lot of these people who work in these like public institutions are very busy and they have their own frameworks. And if you can't fit into their framework, it is actually very hard for them to help you. But if you're polite, they might direct you and they probably will to someone who might be better able to help you. So eventually I came to an office that actually gave out emergency motel vouchers. And I got one for like 4 weeks nearby. And then the indigent food people, they said, here's enough, here's like, they gave me these packs and they said, these are like 8 meals and come back every day and we'll give you 8 new meals. And then I, without a phone, got the hotel. I thought I was safe. I had scheduled an appointment with doctors at Grady for medical check. And I'm like, okay, I'm good. And then I was like, let's get high. So I got high. And then the next day, or not the next day, a few days later, I was high and I was nervous because I had to check in with the emergency housing people. Let me back up a bit. So right before I got high, I actually filled a soda bottle with my own urine before I got high. Because I knew that, or I thought that I'm gonna have to check in a few days. And if they test my urine, it's gonna, because I wanna get high, it's gonna, and I'm gonna lose my motel. So I prepared for that. So a few days later, I'm high. I go back to Grady to the emergency housing office, and I spill my bottle of urine in the lobby.
Word. So foiled plan.
And the woman was like, you know, we don't check. You didn't have to do this. She was like, you can be high, not high. Your voucher is only good for 4 weeks and it can't be extended. So you might want to think about cleaning up your act and finding somewhere to go after. And it was so matter of fact. It wasn't like condemnatory. It wasn't judgmental. It wasn't like, I'm going to take this away from you. It was just like, by the way, the clock is ticking on your housing and you best find something. And so in that time period, I found the extension in Marietta, which, you know, I can't say enough good things about it. They definitely need support. So everyone go on to the extension.org. They just built a huge new addition so they can house many more people, but they need support. So the extension.org, it's a nonprofit. Everyone in Cobb breaks their back to support it, churches, clubs. So it's truly a grassroots place and it was free, but after a few weeks, I went on job search, and despite having a master's and thinking I was so fancy, I walked up the street and got hired immediately at Jimmy John's. And I was the cashier. I had a great time. I love Jimmy John's. It's a great place.
In case you missed that, he definitely has a very successful degree that preceded this story for him. So we'll talk about that on the second half, but go ahead.
So I got a great job at Jimmy John's, and I started as at the end of the sandwich line, and then they thought, oh, you know, you might make a good cashier, and I actually became the number one pickle up salesman in the state of Georgia because I developed this little trick. After someone ordered, I would say cookie and a pickle, And people would be like, nah. And then I just reverse it and be like, oh, okay, how about pickle and a cookie? And then everyone would be like, almost everyone would be like, I'll take the pickle or oh, I'll take the cookie. And I upsold so many pickles because all you do is you say pickle and a cookie, they say no, and then you reverse it and they're like, oh, I'll take the pickle. And it was just something because I was bored. I'm like, oh, I'm so sick. I'm tired of asking people for pickle and a cookie and them saying no. So one day I just reversed it and they were all saying yes.
So how long did you have that job during this recovery
So
time?
yeah, so I worked at so I was at the extension for the full 12 months, and then I got my own. I entered the private rental market, and I got an apartment at Jimmy John's. I worked at Jimmy John's probably I think for 7 months, and then I got a higher paying job, actually at a answering service for doctors. I would. Doctors, especially on weekends, and they pick one of eight to answer calls, and then you get like a lot of people calling after hours, and you have to figure out what's pageable or what's textable, and it's really interesting work
Who
because
would ever think that it would possibly be somebody who's in a recovery program answering that phone, though?
yeah, I mean, I had to go through like background checks and stuff like that, and I had never been arrested, so it was. And there it was very, I mean, I'm not, I don't, it was very, it was, I wasn't quite working at a 911, right? It was,
Right.
it was a lot of birth controls after 5 o'clock calls.
Oh, that's funny. Oh my goodness. Well,
You know what I mean?
so you spent that year there. That would and it met
Yeah.
all of those needs and your criteria in the right order.
Yeah, it meant everything. So we, I was there. We did credit work. We did life skills. We did 12-step recovery. We did group therapy. There was so much fun because they have a really extensive alumni network. Come and take us to movies or take us all these activities. They had a baseball team. They had, and while we were there, it's free at the point of entry, and then you sort of detox for a couple of weeks and you get into the program, and the food is amazing, by the way. The food is, I couldn't say enough about the food, and that's great. But and then you go to work, you get a job, and then you have to save most of your money, and then you when you get a job, like a percentage of your income goes obviously to the extension, and then you save some of it, most of it, and then you have like for cigarettes or for whatever you need. But they take care of, they have like what they call Macy's upstairs, which is like this huge floor of really nice clothes that people have donated. So people like me who came with like two pair of mismatched socks with holes in it, I could, when I went on job search, or if a lot of people actually get jobs in offices and they could dress appropriately for that.
How appropriate. I love that. Okay, so I think we're going to have to cut for the break. And when we come back for our second half, we will hear a little more of how he found himself homeless and then how he came out after he comes out of the extension and where that landed him and where he is now. And you will be surprised how we will segue into the COVID litigation summit, but I'm not going to give up that secret yet. So you'll have We will pick right back up there on the second half, but we're going to have to cut for an intermission for our sponsors. Don't forget to check out our online store at americaoutloud.shop, where you can find all the sponsors and products that make it possible for us to bring you these wonderful interviews on our network. And they're at a discounted rate, including Nurses Out Loud personal sponsor, ASEA powdered dietary supplement performance packs. They have the Redox Energy Mind and Mood that have 10 of each in the pack. But because of today's topic being about mental health, I want to encourage you to give Redox Mood powdered drink a try. Choose tropical flavored Redox Mood for sustained cellular calmness and good mood. Because when you feel good, you are strong. Use promo code OUTLOUD to save 15% off your purchase. I'll catch you on the other side of this break. Stay with us.
It's time.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Often, there are no symptoms, but left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. It's time to fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar that you eat. but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Developed by world-renowned scientists and backed by 15 years of research, HealRight is effective, but it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. Step out of the statistics and use food as medicine. Visit HealRight.com/outloud or AmericaOutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
ASEA believes that inside each of us is the potential to feel and be our very best. Our customers will tell you how our products have made a difference for them, from improving immune health, regulating hormone balance, supporting gut health, to soothing the skin, even reducing the appearance of wrinkles, fine lines, and cellulite, and providing targeted support for mind, mood, energy, and even our body's own production of collagen. Make our breakthrough products an essential step in becoming your best self and fulfilling your greatest potential. ASEA, we power potential. For exclusive savings, use code OUTLOUD to save 15% off your first order today.
Millions of Americans are needlessly suffering from the long-haul effects of the toxic spike protein. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company designed their spike support formula to counteract harmful spike protein from COVID-19 and vaccines so you can feel your best. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order.
58 million people suffer from joint aches and stiffness in the U.S. every day. Ignoring chronic joint discomfort can affect mobility and your quality of life. Advanced Nutrition Company, HealthyCell, created joint health and mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexible range of motion. And HealthyCell's not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow with clinically proven ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients. You would need to take 11 pills to get the same amount of nutrients in each gel pack. And these great-tasting gels come in a small packet. Tear off the top, shoot it down, or mix it in water. It's 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. HealthyCell.com, code OUTLOUD for 25% off.
When God, through His grace and mercy, gave us free will, the will of the people was to live freely. To that end, we fight for the liberty of all at a time when global tyranny threatens us as never before in mankind's history. This vision is manifest at AmericaOutloud.news, a site for all who cherish free will and freedom. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Time and this is war. Welcome back to Nurses Out Loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. I'm your host, Nurse Michelle. Wherever you're listening from today and whatever you're doing, I thank you for giving me the gift of your time. Be sure to make America Out Loud News your daily stop for all the latest news and happenings where it is uncensored, because we all must do our part and share the stories, the articles, the podcasts, the videos, so we can help secure America's future and make sure that everyone that's out there that's seeking freedom can find their path to that. I'm here with David Ragsdale, and we have been talking about the path into and out of homelessness, and we're going to tell you some help and hope for how to help loved ones find their way back to themselves and place. And welcome back, David, and let's start back with that. Like, when you got out of your situation with homelessness, it was the extension program in Marietta, Georgia that made such an impact for you. And then when you got to the end of your 1 year there, what happened for David then?
So I got an apartment in Marietta. It was great. And I had, you know, improved my credit. I had stacked some money. So I was able to, I had health insurance. And I, sometime thereafter, I actually went to work and helping. It was, I was paid for it, so I wasn't a volunteer. But basically, doing housing coordination for the extension, whereby people would essentially, what I did all day was I would take calls and then try to discern if they were eligible to come in, right? Because the need is much greater than the number of available beds at any one time, right?
Right. And so you gotta choose the right best selection.
Yeah, and there were, because it's funded, it's mainly funded, of course, through the people and churches of Cobb and the surrounding counties, and it's just so community supported. But there, since there is some HUD funding, some state funding, some county funding, there are some rules about eligibility and stuff like that. And so people call in. And at first it's like you're dealing with someone who's really at a really low point in their life that's pretty traumatic, which is not having housing and a concurring addiction. And so it's trying to be like friendly, but also like efficient, because, you know, if you there's a series of filter questions, right? And if a person's not eligible to like apply, then I pivoted. Okay, let's try to find you something that is available. And to be honest, that was the most both interesting and joyful part of the job, because if they could be eligible, and because I wasn't a counselor, I wasn't an addiction counselor, so I didn't have anything to do with someone's application once they came in and did the in-person application part of that. That was for that team. And I just prayed and wished them the best. And I knew that the team that did the admissions into the extension were loving and smart people. But where I got to have a little bit of really interesting work, and it was very interesting, is when they weren't eligible. And then it was like, okay, so here, let's try to find you something right now in Metro Atlanta where you can go. And that was a real interesting part of the job, because I got to know every type of housing. I had, you know, figure out what's available, who has beds open where, how do you get someone from a crisis detox center across, you know, down into Atlanta when they don't have any money? Like, how do you get someone who's in a hospital into the crisis center when the ambulance won't take them there? And it's a really long walk that's very confusing. So it was a little bit like logistics and supply chain when you have zero resources. And it was very interesting work, because, you know, I'm not responsible for the person on the other end of the phone, but I want as best as possible to get them as close as possible to a bed that was available. And that was real interesting work.
Yeah, something that Matt, I became aware of is the importance of the Greyhound bus station that still exists in the world. And the Atlanta Greyhound bus station is a cultural experience in and of itself. And if you haven't been inside of a Greyhound bus station, you do not know what we're talking about here, but they are unique because there are people that don't have transportation. That's why you're there. You do not have your own ability to get where you need to go. And this is a reasonably economical way to do it. So thank goodness Atlanta does have that. Plus, it has transit inside of the city as well. So you were probably tapping into that. What about the only thing that I often found was a resource was 211. I think calling 211 United Way would basically say, you say, you know, I'm a domestic abuse survivor. I'm trying to find a shelter for me to stay until I can do and with or without a child, et cetera. That was my primary use of doing that. But then having a loved one that was addicted and needing help, I found out that they actually had resources as well. And they seemed really willing to help. And a lot of them had loved ones themselves. That's why they were volunteering for that. They knew how important it was to find that. So as you said, people who love these people where they are and able to love them where they are and trying to get them from where they are to a place that is healing. Would you agree with the statement that what doing things for others is a path to healing?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely people, you know, again, I'm a Christian, so I feel that that's part of the purpose of life.
Yeah.
But even if someone doesn't have that, I think there is something almost like chemical that happens to us. Mother Teresa told this famous story where one of her nuns who was in the novitiate, so very early in her her order had given a bag of rice to someone very poor, this poor woman in line. And then the woman just ran off and left and didn't say thank you. And this new nun, this novice, was like a little potato. Like, she didn't even say thank you. She just took it. And then, so the story goes, Mother Teresa is like, well, you know, we're not really doing it for gratitude. That's not why we're here, right? And then the next day, the woman who had taken the rice came back and she thought, oh, I wanted to say, I'm sorry for leaving so quickly. My neighbor was starving and I had to give half to her.
Oh, my goodness.
Right? So, and this woman was starving too. So like, that's the thing, right? Like anyone, even you see this, you even see this, like there is a dignity in being able to help someone. And you often see this even among very under-resourced, even, people without housing, is that they feel better about themselves when they can give even small things. Saint Teresa of Lisieux called this her little flowers, right? She was another nun. And so she said once to someone, I can't do these big grand gestures of charity because I'm in a convent. All I can do is these little flowers to people every day, whether it's a smile, one kind word, anything. And these are my little flowers. And we're all capable of that. Even the most drugged out homeless person can sometimes do something of such small charity, but that cracks open the light just as much as someone who gives $1 billion.
I love it. There's no doubt that in my mind that the need for beauty, I think women particularly have a need to be in beauty or surrounded by beauty. They make things beautiful. Women are beautiful by all kinds. And whatever, when they're in a place that is surrounded by ugliness, dirt, and squalor because they're homeless, it doesn't change that their soul has a need to be reminded of beauty. So for this nun to even be just giving a flower to, let's just say, a woman, homeless person, but not just that only a woman would be encouraged by that. I'm just saying it's a small gift, which brings up another question I want to ask you. Charity, often within Christian organizations, maybe the detached arm approach is really what's more common. People think I can donate financially to my church that's going to do it, or I can bring canned goods and they're going to, there's the other people are going to get in contact with the homeless shelter people, or I'm going to volunteer once a month at the homeless shelter and feed people. But it's not uncommon. I happen to live in an academic town, so there's a lot of addiction in an academic town. And there's very young people, young men and young women, who look like they're fit for work, right? As if they could work. And I see a lot of these videos go around, even on social media, where there's this very young, fit looking man or woman looking like they are able-bodied to work, and they're begging for food. And people that comment are saying things like, get a job. And having had somebody I loved be in this situation, I said, you have no idea the paralysis they may be in. It could be a jail sentence that actually has something on their record at that moment that may keep them from the majority of jobs, that the amount of jobs that are available for them are very limited. And these people are coping with addiction, so they're powerless. They may not have a place to sleep, and they may be hungry. So what do you say to the people who are out there who see the homeless and want to say, get a job, or the person begging on the side of the street? What would be the best response for someone at your stoplight or something like that?
I don't know. I mean, there are probably some people flipping signs who can and should get a job. There are probably most, I don't know, I have not done like a statistical analysis, but a fair number of people flipping signs are going to go and take that money and buy drugs with it or alcohol. And then there are going to be some who take it to get food, or, and there's a lot of like cross subsidies that can happen. Like maybe they were given $20 yesterday, which they used to buy drugs, and are using today's money to pay for their motel. I don't know. It's really tricky to get involved into the internal financial calculations of A, someone who's homeless, or B, someone who's addicted, or C, both, because everyone, so I did economics as an undergrad too. I did classics in economics. And so everyone has a budget, even people who are enumerate, right? Everyone has a budget, whether it's Elon Musk or it's the guy flipping a sign at the traffic sign at the traffic stop who you think is homeless. Everyone does these calculations, and they're all inscrutable, right? So it's hard to come up with a type of like rule book for that. What it is one, people should always be safe, right? And now sometimes if one were to approach someone asking for money with anything other than money, like a food, like a McDonald's gift certificate or McDonald's or whatever, there could be a bad reaction, right? And so safety always has to come first. And B, it really is on the spirit of the person that, sure, you can give them money. There are sometimes I just hand a dollar through my car window, right? Just because the spirit moves me. But in that sense, it's like buying a lottery ticket, meaning I'm doing it because it makes me feel good. Just like when I buy a lottery ticket, I'm not buying it because I'm actually going to win. I'm buying it so I can have the 2-minute fantasy. And that's the same thing about giving cash to someone on the street. Just understand why you're doing it. And if the spirit moves you and it's safe, you know what I mean? It's fine.
How long were you actually in homelessness, in a state of homelessness?
Well, yeah, I mean, we talked about this, according to the federal government, several years, but actually without, I think, safe and stable housing, I would say probably 2-3 months.
Oh, really? Okay. And according to HUD, you did tell me this on the break, that there's a definition for homelessness. Why don't you tell them that? It may be different right now, but what was
it?
Yeah,
it may be different now. But when, insofar as I read and was told and it was communicated to me in the course of my work, was that prior to COVID, a federal definition of homelessness, and this might have been to secure grant money or whatever, was basically someone who didn't have a mortgage or a rental agreement or some type of housing situation that was in their name. So that, for example, if you had a kid who was sleeping on your couch, technically, according to some federal definition, that child was homeless, right? Unless they were on like a lease agreement or something like that, right? So if you're couch surfing with friends, even if they have a very nice guest bedroom, like in Beverly Hills, you are homeless. Or at least you were before COVID. I don't know what's changed since COVID. It seems a lot have changed, but I don't know if that has changed or not.
And the data definitely increased. Addiction increased during COVID. Suicide increased during COVID. And homelessness increased during COVID. And you were in Atlanta when this was happening. But California has some very, tragic looking streets all over LA where you're from. And, you know, just tent cities. That is where the person I know that was homeless actually was homeless. And the knowledge that I became aware of what these people live like, and the fact that the government actually facilitates some of it. Would you like to expose a little bit about
for many decades, actually, we've been talking in Los Angeles about like the homeless industrial complex. We spend billions and billions of billions just in LA. We've passed city taxes, city bonds, county of Los Angeles, state of California. 20 years ago, when he was mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom said that I'm going to get rid of homelessness if only you give me more money. What it seems to be doing is making the problem worse. But what it, and we think how that is doing it is the, like, it's definitely providing a very comfortable middle class lifestyle to bureaucrats at homeless NGOs or agencies that are created. They are living very comfortable and nice lives, making $250,000 a year. And that the number of people with those jobs have exploded. And so they actually have a financial incentive for the problem to get worse. There are no incentives for homelessness to actually be solved or be created. And I think, you know, if your listeners want to Google Michael Schellenberger, he came from the left. Now he's not on the left, and he came from the progressive left. And he's actually done a lot of work on this homelessness industrial complex and how corrupt it is. And it's called San Francisco, like Sicko.
Wow.
And it's a really powerful book. And I would urge everyone to read it, and they can really get into the weeds of, you know, so while I think everyone should support group, you know, like places like the Extension, at the same time, you know, next time your city or your county government is coming to you for this huge bond thing to solve homelessness, I would be weary of doing that. I would be weary of voting yes on that.
Is that right? Because it looks like the money is actually going to finance the people.
If the money is there, it's not a resource problem. The money is there. So they keep saying, oh, the money's not there. And it's like, well, in the past decade, you've spent billions in even in just this, not like billions nationally, you know, but like in this small space, we spend all this money. Where does that money go? How come it costs so much? Right. They talk about how much. A lot of times they talk about like, oh, it costs $70,000 a year per prisoner to house and feed them in a prison. Right. But the cost, if you add it all up for like a lot of these places in terms of that are riding the homelessness flood of money, it's even more than that. And like, it shouldn't even be that because you're not building these like hugely insane secure complexes. So right. There's so much fraud that goes on.
Okay. It looks like the churches are actually being the more successful at producing good outcomes because they're privately funded predominantly, like the extension was. You said that a lot of the churches in that area in Cobb County, Georgia, did their part to try and help support that program and make it successful.
Yeah. So, there were two things that like it, that if you're a member of a church, right, and your church is either considering like a new initiative to support some type of housing or something like that. The two things I would look at is how much does this organization take from the state and what type of mandates do, not just COVID mandates, but what does that mean? Because you could have a faith-based place that starts up as like a faith-based resource for homeless and addiction. But once they start taking too many different streams of money from the state, the county, the city, the federal government, they essentially become like, then what you find out is the soul is lost and the number of managers and administrators who work there just explodes, right? So you have this small place and maybe it's, and it was able to do great work for decades with like five people. And then they're like, oh, hey, we're going to want to expand the number of beds. And you're like, okay, so then based on your per staff per bed, you would go to 8 or 9. And they're like, actually, because we're taking this money, we now need to go to 30 or 23. And then it becomes bureaucratic. So churches need to be real careful about that.
Are you doing anything right now to bring this to the attention of the public or in any way working with the homeless sector?
Not now, no. So that's something that I'm working on a couple different startups. And so I've been, as you may know, for the past few years, I've been working with Defeat the Mandates and the VSRF. So that's really taken my, you know, 24 hours a day, helping the vaccine injured, helping those who lost their jobs because of the mandates and making sure that these things never happen again. And so that was where Christ centered me for the past few years. But just in this conversation we've been having, and then what we were talking about that led to this conversation, there is something to this that I think for me, I don't know what yet. So it's something I'll pray on.
Yeah. So how long did you work in that homeless sector in? Because you were there during COVID and you went.
I would know. So I was there at the beginning. So it was real funny. So I was actually, I lived abroad for a few years. So I lived in Taiwan during SARS. So I saw SARS come down and I sort of, when COVID first started, I sort of knew what was going to happen. And my mom had a stroke. So I left in like, I drove back to LA to be with my family during COVID. So I left probably in like May.
And what did you witness? Because a lot of money was being given to the people who were homeless. And you were saying to me that $2,500 didn't quite do what was needed to help people in that.
Everyone went crazy. Everyone went crazy. Everyone had a good old time. Everyone went back to partying. Everyone just said, smoke them if you got them.
Because they had all this money all of a sudden given to them by the government. Word. So the government essentially facilitated the selling of more addiction.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what we've heard about, that that's how things went down. So did you witness anything else that just stands out to you? Because carnage, you know, death.
Yeah, just meeting. I'll say this for Georgia. The meetings in Georgia opened up faster than anywhere in the 12-step recovery meetings. They opened up so fast. And that was a blessing for so many people. We're even faster than Florida. In LA, it took a year and a half before in Georgia meetings, the lockdowns only shut down the meetings for like a month, and then they went back in person. So the recovery in Georgia is strong.
So there's no surprise why so many people flooded our state. Our state was flooded in 2021. I mean, it was like a mass exodus. And when we sold our house was sold in 4 hours for, you know, double the price value. So it's unbelievable what did happen. There was a mass migration across the country. Clearly, Georgia was one of the free states that people were hoping to go into. We opened early and were judged for that. But obviously, the trickle down even impacted the homeless by being able to gain access to programs that were helping being opened again.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. Well, I want to make sure everybody knows we're going to be doing a show with David on the COVID litigation summit. So why don't you do a quick shout out for that for us?
We are doing our second COVID litigation conference where the best lawyers in the field are working to further the practice along. So people have been fired because they wouldn't get the vaccine. If you're a lawyer, you need to be. This is the biggest growing field of litigation in the country. And to learn more, go to covidlitigation.com.
And why don't you go ahead and shout out for the replatform for us while we're doing it.
Right after that, we're having a conference for the freedom economy. So if you're an entrepreneur, an investor, or just a consumer who wants to start using businesses that don't hate your values, go to replatformvegas.com. That's replatformvegas.com.
Thank you so much, David, for being here and telling us your story. And we're not done talking to you because we're going to bring some more topics here to the Nurses Out Loud audience. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow. A glimpse through the journey into and out of homelessness. Nurses Out Loud wants to remind our audience that there are amazing souls out there trapped in addiction and homelessness. People who are hungry, really, really hungry. Take what you have learned here today and share the hope and help found in David's story. If you feel trapped in addiction or homelessness, know that there is place for you. Healing and freedom await you. Walk in that direction until you find yourself on the other side. Until next week.
It's time.